Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Alex Kruger in London, and you're listening to World Review from the New Statesman, a twice-weekly international news podcast. Every Thursday, we come together to unpack some of the most significant stories in world affairs, and every Monday, we interview a guest for their unique perspective and expertise. Today I'm speaking to John Simpson, the veteran foreign correspondent and world affairs editor for the BBC. He's been back to Afghanistan for the first time since Kabul fell to the Taliban in August. John, you've been covering Afghanistan for decades. You saw the Taliban when they were in power before. Are they different this time? They've been making a great effort to convince the world that they are.
I think they are. I mean, it's very early and they've got a lot of pressures on them to look and sound like a kind of regular government. But when you look back to the period when they were in power before, 1996 to 2001, when I used to go quite often to Afghanistan, they're very, very different from that time. That's not to say that there aren't tendencies within the Taliban to be exactly the same as they were. And there are various, all sorts of well-recorded examples of brutality and cruelty, very reminiscent of 1996 onwards. But in terms of the way that the government runs things in Kabul, they do seem to be different and they seem to want to be different. How long that will last, if they don't get the kind of support from the West in particular that all of this is intended to gather, then who knows how quickly they may revert to something else. But I would say that at the moment they want to seem different and it's kind of working pretty much on the kind of street level in Kabul and indeed in the other places that I visited. But that's not to say anything about how they'll behave in future if it doesn't come about that they get Western support.
And what was Kabul like? How did the city feel?
Well, I was there, a couple of months now after the fall. I think it must have been very weird in the early couple of weeks and so forth after they took over. But now it's relatively normal. I mean, it looked fairly similar to how it's always looked in the 20 years since the Taliban were thrown out in 2001. So that's to say plenty of goods in the shop still, although a declining amount for various reasons. Plenty of cars in the streets, which of course was never the case when the Taliban were in power before. And people fairly willing to talk openly about their experience of the Taliban and what's going on. And that that, I take it, is probably the most important element of the lot.
And what was the mood among the people you spoke to? Were they resigned? Were they fearful? Did they think this was a good thing? Kabul is different, of course, from the rest of the country, but did people even think, well, it's got to be better than the internationally backed government, which had a terrible reputation for corruption and incompetence?
Yes, absolutely. A justified reputation. Inevitably, people were different in what they said. It depended on their class and their income and their sex, their gender, and so forth. But basically, a lot of people that I spoke to seemed to be putting a good face on it. Well, at least the Taliban will bring an end to fighting, although actually there really wasn't very much fighting before the Taliban took over. There is very much a sense, starting to be a sense, that the Taliban aren't delivering what everybody hoped that they would deliver, which is firm control of the streets, firm control of crime and disorder. And there are lots and lots of cases every day of cars being hijacked, of people being accosted by bandits, essentially, and taken away for ransom. It happened to my crew and I. What exactly happened, we couldn't work out, but a couple of guys on motorbikes turned up with weapons, and one of them jokingly said, "We've come to take you away." It didn't happen. In fact, because they spoke Dari, and because I don't speak Dari, I couldn't understand what it was all about until I spoke to our colleague afterwards, who explained what had happened. But he couldn't understand it. I can't understand it. It was a kind of symptom of the general sort of lawlessness. I mean, I've spent so much time in Afghanistan over the decades. Nothing like that has ever happened to me before. And I can't help thinking that whether or not it was in any way serious or maybe just even a joke doesn't really matter. It's the fact that nobody ever said that kind of thing in the past, and they are saying it now.
When the Taliban were in power before, they weren't actually very interested in government or anything really outside of Islamic law. 20 years later, they came back. They found this structure of government had been put in place, and however imperfect, it had delivered a measure of prosperity to people. Now, what do they think of this, and how are they coping with the expectations of managing a country, of running an economy?
Well, I really wish I'd been able to speak to them before, Alex. I mean, I think this is an absolutely key question. Did they come in thinking it was 1996 all over again, or did they realize how much a city like Kabul had changed in 20 years? I don't know that they did. And I get the impression it might have been quite a kind of fierce awakening for them to find that all the expectations that people now have, that their government will protect them under certain circumstances, that they can rely on probably corrupt government, but nevertheless, they have their expectations of what a corrupt government ought to be doing. And I think that must have been quite a shock to many of the Taliban people coming into power and seeing that things were different. People wanted, had greater expectations of their government than anything that they'd imagined in the past.
Because it was 20 years. It's not like it was 6 months and then this experiment collapsed. You've got a whole generation who have come up to see Afghanistan just as another developing country, however imperfect, however flawed. Are those people pushing back at all? Did you see any signs of not necessarily armed resistance to Taliban rule, but political resistance? There have been reports, for example, of women in some parts of the country demonstrating for education.
Yes, I was told that. I wasn't able to check it out, but I was told that every day there are demonstrations of different kinds demanding, well, different things really, but often the right to education, the right for women to be able to live their lives as they choose, by men to demand the kind of freedom from oppressive policing, for instance, that they've come to expect. Afghanistan was a deeply, deeply flawed country, and it was one of the very poorest on earth, but there were signs that it was improving. And exactly as you say, you've got to be about 35, 36 to remember with any accuracy any kind of state before the just recent present. And so there are expectations which everybody has and which they're not prepared just quickly to relinquish. And the interesting thing for me was I got the feeling that the Taliban had grasped that it was going to be really, really hard to go back to those old days. I mean, actually, I think perhaps the most critical element of it is simply the size of the population. By 2001, when the Taliban left office, there were supposedly, I mean, nobody actually counted heads, but there was supposedly something like 5.5 million people in the entire country. I've no idea whether that was true, but that's a figure that's banded about. And now it's right up to sort of 30 million, 40 million. And it's very, very hard to control a country of that kind of size. You can just about do it if there's 500,000 people in the capital city. You can run a city like that with vigilantes meeting out rough justice on the street corners, which I saw plenty of between 1996 and 2001. Much, much harder now. If you're to do something which local passers-by don't like, don't approve of, and they're there in numbers, quite difficult for a small group of vigilantes, for instance, to impose their will.
Wherever you are in the world,
if you're interested in global affairs,
you can subscribe to The New Statesman on digital, in print, or both, for as little as £1 a week at newstatesman.com/subscribe.
That's just $2 a week in America.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
what about the economy? Because international donors froze the transfer of funds to Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover, and yet international aid accounted for 40% of the economy. What happens when you take away 40% from an already small economy? Are the effects beginning to be felt?
They really are. They're more felt kind of emotionally, I think, just at the moment than in hard, real terms. But people are getting terrified of what's going to happen. It's quite rare to find anybody who gets a decent pay packet. And again and again and again, must have happened, dozens and dozens of times, if not more, to me. People saying that they used to be paid up until the time the Taliban took over. They've had no money since. And there are plenty of goods in the shops, and there's plenty of food around. I mean, okay, fine. A lot of that is the fruit that comes in from the kind of end of harvest time. But nevertheless, I mean, you could walk down the street of any town or city or village, indeed, that I went to, and see plenty of food around. It's not the supply that's in question, it's people's ability to pay for it. And again and again, as I say, I spoke to people who genuinely were running out of cash. When they run out of cash, doesn't matter how much is in the on the market stalls or in the shops, people are going to begin to starve. They're already starving. I mean, a man told me that he'd had to take his, I think, seven children to the mosque and just simply abandon them there because he couldn't afford to feed them any longer, couldn't really afford to feed himself. And he said, I couldn't bear to see my children starve to death in front of my eyes. And I think that sort of thing, you hear more and more and more instances of that all the time. So if it comes to, if it's going to be a hard winter and everybody says they think it is, then I think we're going to see real death on quite a large scale, death from starvation. This is why I got really quite emotional, which is, you know, I've tried in the time-honored old BBC way not to get too involved in anything I report, but I just came down from interviewing a family who, you know, would under any other circumstances be likely to die of hunger really quite soon. And I mean, I have to say, I don't want to go into any details, but my team made sure that family at least will make it through the winter and will be okay.
You can't do that for every family, and there must be so many families, and you must have seen so much of this.
Well, you've just got to look around you just to see how many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people are now threatened with this. They're on the very, very cliff edge. And in a moment, who knows, they could be lost. And that's a very moving thing. I mean, I've covered, sadly, quite a few, instances of mass starvation and so forth over the decades. But to see an entire society which is about to head that way and it isn't quite there yet is something that I've never experienced before. And I found it deeply, deeply moving and unsettling.
What should donors do? Because there is this dilemma. Do you give money to a Taliban government with all the human rights abuses that it's associated with, or do you give money to a Taliban government, or do you say this is the consequence of what's happened and we're not going to give any money at all? What should donors do?
Well, I think there's two things. There's plenty that individual people can do. There are aid agencies who are working in Afghanistan, regardless of who's in power and what the attitude of the outside world is. And the World Food Programme of the United Nations is one, and there's a whole lot of others. So, I mean, it is possible, if one feels so inclined, to give money to those agencies, and the money will go to the people that it's intended for. I mean, one of the things people say again and again and again, I think is perhaps a little bit of an excuse, but they say, oh, well, we don't know, it'll all go to the Taliban. The Taliban will steal it. Not so. According to the agencies that I spoke to, the Taliban themselves are getting really scared of what's happening, and they're desperate for outside agencies to come in and sort things out for themselves. And I saw a distribution by the World Food Programme of large amounts of food, and the Taliban were just standing back, about four soldiers, just really making sure that nobody, you know, there wasn't any trouble. And I think that's pretty general picture over the whole of the country. What the problem is, I suspect, is that outside governments, Western governments in particular, think that they've got more time to play with than they actually have. And I think they're trying to put pressure on the Taliban to promise that they'll behave properly. And in the meantime, they're blocking, of course, the reserves of Afghanistan and any kind of financial aid going in from governments. And my feeling, having been there, is that this is a game that should have been played months ago. If it was going to be, it should have been played in August when the Taliban, but not in November, not at the end of November, when food stocks are people's ability to buy the food stocks is so appallingly threatened. That's just my feeling from having seen it. China and Russia, particularly China, pushing large amounts of food into the country, but there's all sorts of evidence that the Taliban are quite uncomfortable about having Chinese or being reliant on Chinese help, and they would actively like to have Western powers sending in help as well.
That's fascinating. I hadn't realised that China was becoming such a player in post-fall of Kabul, Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see them there. You don't see any sign, really, of Chinese influence. But it's just that the Taliban themselves talk about their reluctance to be dependent on China, from which one assumes that the Chinese are saying, leave it all to us. We can sort out all your problems if you'll just let us, and if you'll, you know, make certain agreements with us. And one of the arguments that comes up again and again is about the, of course, the Chinese government's approach to ethnic minorities who are Muslims. And the Taliban are deeply reluctant to be wholly dependent on a country which treats its Muslim inhabitants in the way China does.
And you managed to get out of Kabul. You were in Bamyan in central Afghanistan. What was the atmosphere like there? How different was it?
Well, it was very different. I saw more poverty in Bamyan than I did in Kabul. Maybe that was just because I didn't go to the right places. In fact, I think that is quite likely. But Bamyan is a town which has been quite prosperous in the past, but which is now really, I would have thought, almost entirely composed of people who in any other society would be regarded as bitterly poor. And that was really very painful to see again, yet again, people who are just clinging on by their fingernails and who, you know, already starting to fall into hunger and chaos. And that was more evident, more obvious in Bamyan than in Kabul, where there are greater reserves of cash and food and supplies and families that will help and so forth.
So I've been lucky enough to work in Afghanistan, and I think it's something that people who've never been there are surprised to hear, but there is something very captivating about the country. There is something very endearing about it. And when I saw what was happening in Kabul, I felt sick, but in particular thinking of the journalists I'd worked with, the young women journalists working for the BBC's Persian language service, and to think of what was happening to them. You must know so many people, and how do you feel about their future? Are you afraid for them? What have they told you?
Well, yes. I mean, all you can do is listen to people and make your judgments, of course, about whether their fears are likely. But yes, I mean, I thought that I spoke to three women whom I used to know as journalists there, and none of them was working as a journalist now. They're too frightened, and I'm afraid. I think their fears are thoroughly justified. It does depend, I think, on the way that things go. If the Western countries were to say, okay, we used to fight you when you were the Taliban, we tried everything in our power to stop you becoming the government, now you have become the government, we are happy to let bygones be bygones and do what we can to encourage you to behave well in government and, if necessary, succeed. It's quite a hard thing to say that to the United States. Britain have lost loads and loads of soldiers, spent trillions of dollars in fighting the Taliban. But I think if that were said in one way or another, one level, privately or publicly, I think it would enable the Taliban to be more prepared to behave like any other government, rather than this ultra-extreme religious doctrinal government that they have been in the past. And I just think it's important to say, you don't see really any sign of that now. You know, I mean, when they were in power before, they'd conduct searches of houses to see if they could find any image of any living creature, beat the people that own such an image. I mean, it could be anything, you know, it's a picture of a bird or a little kid or something like that, a child's decoration for a child's room. And those people would be beaten and the picture would be destroyed. They're not doing that now. And my guess is they realize that such a thing would be absolutely impossible.
When will you next be in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it were up to me, and you talked about how lovely it is, I really think it's just about my favorite country on earth. Something about the mountains, something about the people, something about the way they are. I mean, over the years, Afghans have, well, given their lives for me. Several people have died to protect me, and that kind of loyalty and affection is very it's very impressive. And when you've benefited from it, you can't just easily turn your back on the place. My own circumstances are changing in that I'm going to be presenting a weekly program in the new year, and that means that my chances of getting back to Afghanistan reasonably soon will be pretty slight. I mean, it takes forever to get there and it takes forever to get out again. And I won't have that on a weekly program. I wouldn't really probably have that amount of scope. But, I'm not being sentimental. I'm not putting it on for effect when I say that Afghanistan is really very, very close to my heart. And I can't tell you how happy I was when I walked down the aircraft steps and just felt the air and smelt smells and saw the sights of Afghanistan again. So until I do get back there, I'll be really, really sad.
I hope it'll be soon. John Simpson, thank you for talking to us. This has been the World Review from the New Statesman. You can read all our international coverage on newstatesman.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend or even an enemy and rate us and leave a nice review. The producer has been Adrian Bradley. The team will be back on Thursday. I'm Alex Kruger. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.